went to look for him, did not find him, so then he gave her another map. Thereafter, they both had a disagreement about what his requirements should be. She took him into her supervisor.
As to confirming the residence and approving that residence?
The only thing that she did after that was, I think one time she drove by the area where he said he resided and did not see him. So that was it.
Did he resist? And I get that, kind of get that impression that with the allegation that he failed to cooperate with his supervising officer, was that in relation to disclosing where he was residing?
It was in relationship to her putting all these requirements on him, which he felt were not part of
that. But it had nothing to do with his failure to disclose where he was residing.
At the time they got into the disagreement, it specifically had to do with him not wanting to do any analysis. And she wanted him to start reporting more often. He had been reporting once a month. At that time, I don't believe it had to do with his residence.
When was the last time he reported where he was residing?
After this was filed? Before this was filed?
Yes.
He had, I believe, reported in August. That was when they had the disagreement. And then he sent a cease and desist letter and said that he did not want to have any more contact with them. So he did not report after that.
Now, is that in and of itself enough to cause him to violate the terms and conditions set forth on his lifetime supervision?
I would argue it wasn't.
Well, you would argue that, but is it?
No. Because there's no proof in the trial that he resided in any other location than the last place where he said that he resided. They did not prove that he was not, that he had moved. The place was not within 500 feet of an area primarily used for children. And he had no communication with the victim or the witness in this case.
Okay.
So I contend they didn't prove this. They would have to prove he was living somewhere else. And they didn't prove that. Now, this isn't the first time she drove by that area and didn't find him. She had done that before, and they had a discussion about it, and he drew another map. I think it's important to realize that she put these curfews on him, and that's when she would go to look for him. And she only did it, I think, twice or maybe three times.
Right, but your contention is at no point did he ever affirmatively say he wasn't going to provide his place of residence.
Well, he had drawn the map, and he never...
No, I'm saying after the map was drawn.
After the map, I don't believe he did. I believe he objected to all the restrictions they put on him. You know, curfew is not under...
Correct. Curfew is a different thing. There's certain conditions that must be met under the terms of lifetime supervision. And what I'm trying to determine is whether or not those conditions specifically were not complied with.
With regard to the residence, there was no proof that he did not register his residence with the law enforcement agency. He was found not guilty of that.
Okay.
They did not present anything.
Ms. Dickinson, as to the conditions on the in the trial, were all the conditions lumped together?
They were. They were planned as and or, so we don't know what the jury may have found he was guilty of and what he wasn't. And most of those conditions were not within the statute. They come from the parole statute.
Ms. Dickinson, you also argued that the statute itself is vague in that it allows the board to impose conditions in a way that does not provide adequate or fair notice to your clients. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Correct. It is vague if the court goes beyond the plain meaning of the words of the statute. If you look at the statute in itself, it's not vague. The plain meaning of it suggests that the only regulations the board can go ahead and develop are regulations that the board is going to use to implement this, not regulations that they're putting on the person who is in the program. So the way the court interpreted the district court, it made it vague because it did not provide notice as to all these other possible restrictions that would be placed on your freedom after you've completed your term of imprisonment. and no longer on parole or probation, and it allowed for arbitrary enforcement, which is what happened here. I mean, she could arbitrarily determine that he needed to be at home at the street corner at 5 p.m. till 5 a.m.
Ms. Dickinson asked that Mr. McNeil was required to sign as a condition of his lifetime supervision that he'd abide by various conditions.
Right.
Were those conditions either regulations that were put forth by the board, or were they just standard conditions from the department for people on the other side that usually are on parole or probation?
The board and the division use standard regulations that were used for parole, people on parole. They then went back and added some additional conditions after he was placed on this, and none of those were within the statute. They were all outside the statute.
Do you agree or disagree that the board is allowed to, it says the board shall establish by regulation a program of lifetime supervision of sex offenders to commence? Can they, within establishing that program, add, if they create regulations, additional?
No, because what happened in this case and what happens in any other case is if they establish something and the person does not abide by it, it's a crime. It's a felony. So they're violating the separation of powers by making acts that are not within the statute a crime.
And you're saying that's because he wasn't on parole?
He wasn't on parole.
So therefore those conditions don't... do not comply with the statute.
Right. The legislator did not incorporate the other statutes within this one. If I could reserve my time for the item.
Good morning, Mr. Cooper.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Jonathan Cooper, and I'm the Deputy District Attorney on behalf of respondents. I would first like to address the appellant's assertion that the legislative branch did not intend for the conditions that were placed on Mr. McNeil to be put in place based on the Administrative Code Regulation 213.290. Essentially, they're arguing that the only requirements that are to be placed on Mr. McNeil or placed on any type of sex offender are the requirements that are explicitly enumerated in the statute. I think that is an error. Specifically, the statute reads that the Board of Parole Commissioners is to establish by regulation a program of lifetime supervision. A few subsections after that, the program of lifetime supervision is further explained that if any sex offender commits a violation of the condition imposed to him on that pursuant to that program, it is a Class B category B felony.
But doesn't that comport with parole and probation as opposed to lifetime supervision specifically? And would you concede that he wasn't on parole?
My understanding of the way the lifetime supervision statute works is that he is not on parole at the time of being on lifetime supervision.
And doesn't the provisions that you just referred to specifically refer to parole and probation instances?
The statute NRS 213.1243 specifically refers to lifetime supervision. And in that statute, it actually explains that the board is to regulate the program. When it actually uses the term, the board shall, and specifically going down to the actual plain language of the statute, the legislature uses the language, the board shall require as a condition, and they use that language multiple times throughout the NRS 213.1243 statute. So that the only logical conclusion with using that language is that the board is required to have some conditions, but the word required necessarily implies that other conditions are not necessarily required. Because of that, in this court in Charlie Brown Construction Corps v. Boulder City explained that statutes should be given a plain meaning and must be construed as a whole, and not be read in a way that would render words or phrases superfluous. So if we read it the way the appellant wants this court to read that statute, the word required would be superfluous. There would be no reason for the legislature to use that word unless there were necessarily other conditions that were not going to be required. Taking that even a step further with the legislative intent, the initial statute that was codified in 1999 had no required conditions in them whatsoever. However, it still contained that same provision. At that point, it was subsection 3, that any violations of a condition of lifetime supervision was a Category B felony punishable by 1 to 6 years. And in this statute, there were no required conditions. So it has to be read that the legislative intent was for the Board of Parole Commissioners to be able to establish additional conditions based on their fact-finding capabilities.
Mr. Cooper, in 2002, this court in Palmer v. State made a distinction between parole and lifetime supervision. And in that, it distinguished these two areas. What you are asserting is almost merging them back together. Why should we consider that in light of Palmer, that drew that distinction and said parole and lifetime supervision are not one and the same?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not arguing that we should actually merge these items back together. In Palmer, the issue was related more towards whether or not lifetime supervision is a collateral or direct consequence of the guilty plea. And I believe this court ruled that because it is a direct consequence of the guilty plea, then a defendant pleading guilty to an offense that lifetime supervision was going to be a punishment for had to necessarily be made aware of that. However, this court also in Palmer explained that in Johnson v. State, this court explained that the Board of Parole Commissioners actually is able to establish the additional conditions of lifetime supervision as it relates to a defendant was arguing that that he was not adequately apprised of what his conditions would be at the time of his guilty plea, therefore his guilty plea was not voluntarily given. But this court ruled in Johnson that did not apply because the Board of Parole Commissioners established those conditions after the fact.
But when we look at this case and look at what they had Mr. McNeil sign, it seemed to be the standard form is provided pursuant to 213.1245, which is as a parole, not lifetime supervision.
And I think the Division of Parole and Probation is using a form. While that form might most likely or most notably be used in a parole type of requirement, I don't think it should only be used in a parole requirement. And specifically, the legislative intent in 213.1243, the actual lifetime supervision statute, specifically addresses the need for probation and parole to advise the offender of what his conditions are pursuant to a form, such as using parole. And specifically, the legislative intent of the lifetime supervision statute explicitly says that lifetime supervision should be deemed parole in very limited circumstances. And specifically, one of those circumstances is when providing the conditions of lifetime supervision as in the form this court has already referenced.
Well, it's kind of a circular argument. I mean, if it's limited and lifetime supervision is limited to those specific instances when it should be deemed a parole type situation, what are those situations that require that type of treatment?
In the statute, the lifetime supervision statute relating to when lifetime supervision should be deemed parole, it's more limited to when they're talking about parole and probation officers being able to enforce the conditions.
Wouldn't that be every single lifetime supervision situation?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. When I refer to limited circumstances, okay. I was referring specifically to only talking about lifetime supervision is only deemed parole in the sense of a parole and probation officer can supervise the individual in the sense of the parole board is supposed to give conditions as they would in a parole case.
But in this particular case, we have an officer who's just on their own initiative placing conditions on lifetime supervision, opposed to what is prescribed under 213 or 1243 in their interactions. And there's no reference to any regulations being promulgated or anything else, even if I accept that, that they've been put forth that gives the parole, the officer, that authority. So what should we do?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think the officer, in this case, Officer Mannion, was actually implementing any additional conditions on Mr. McNeil. The conditions that she was enforcing were specifically curfew. That was actually a condition that was contained in his lifetime supervision requirement, lifetime supervision agreement that he signed several years before she was ever at his...
But it was that a valid agreement that he signed?
And I believe it was, Your Honor, because I believe...
Based on what?
The legislative intent in the lifetime supervision statute...
Are you deeming this ambiguous?
I do not believe the statute is ambiguous.
Then why did we get into legislative history?
I apologize. I believe the legislature intended for this statute to be read in conjunction with the regulations in AC 213.290, which is the regulations that are put in place by parole to determine what conditions of an offender is going to be. So when you read these two together, it's obviously clear that the legislature intended that parole and probation regulate the statute, and they did so in AC 213.290, which allows for them to add additional conditions upon an individual's release.
But 213.1243, which prescribes location of residence and so on, is very specific as to what it requires, and it happens to leave out this other superfluous language that you're talking about.
And I think the requirements that are contained inside of that statute are only referring to what is going to be absolutely required. The legislature is saying to probation and parole, you are supposed to regulate this this program, and at the bare minimum, we want to see these various different requirements. The statute says nothing about these are going to be the only requirements. If that was going to be a legislative intent, they could have easily have said the conditions contained therein, or it's only a violation if you violate any of these conditions. That was not in the statute.
It's not just a violation. It's a new crime in this instance, which is a major distinction from if you're on parole or probation. This is lifetime supervision. And to violate what's set forth in 213.1243 is a new crime. It's not just, i.e., a violation of your unfinished sentence.
Yes, I think that same argument was made in Lockman, where this court heard a case in which the pharmacy board, an individual was upset with the pharmacy board being able to regulate the scheduling of controlled substances. As this court knows, depending on what schedule a controlled substance falls under, it can vary in the length of imprisonment. So I think it's a very similar analogy.
In this case, it says you can't live within so many feet of a school or theater. You can be placed on electronic monitoring. This and another instance, and it doesn't talk in terms about the officers, you know, has authority to say, well, you must be at the residence between these hours. You must do certain other things. I guess the other major concern, though, is going to trial and having this verdict that has a number of items placed together where we can't sort out if the jury, in fact, found this person guilty of all these violations. And why wouldn't it be appropriate to remand this back because of that?
Yeah, I believe that all of the conditions that were violated, that were dictated in the information, were appropriate conditions. So I believe the jury has the purview to determine if you violate any of those conditions because they were all appropriate conditions.
Mr. Cooper, let's assume hypothetically that all of the conditions except residence approval are not appropriate for a Category B felony. Returning to the Chief's questions of Ms. Dickinson, I have this question for you. Section 3A of 213.1243 requires the sex offender to reside at a location that has been approved by the parole and probation officer. And the chief's question was, had the parole and probation officer approved the residence of Mr. McNeil? It appeared, at least initially, it had been approved. Would you agree with that?
And yes, my understanding is initially the residence had been approved. However, the issue was he was actually not residing at the residence that was subsequently approved. Because he was homeless, he registered at an intersection. The intersection in which he registered at had several different alleyways throughout that general area. Mr. McNeil registered at that specific intersection. He had not registered at a specific alleyway related to that intersection. So when the probation and parole officer attempted to locate him on multiple occasions, she was unable to do so because he was not residing at the location in which she had subsequently or previously approved.
Were those facts and was that argument made to the jury in this case?
That argument was made to the jury in this case, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So that leads to my next question, if I may. Mr. McNeil was homeless. What if the parole and probation officer had said, I don't care that you're homeless, you must reside in a physical residence. You can't give me an intersection or an alley as your residence. You have to give me a place where you're going to reside. And the individual didn't do it or couldn't do it because of their homelessness condition. Could you prosecute successfully for a Category B felony in that hypothetical?
I don't think so, because I think that's a different scenario in the sense of if someone's homelessness is preventing them from being able to complete one of the requirements, I believe the probation and parole officer would have never submitted on a case bat because the requirement that a residence needs to be approved.
The statutory language says the residence has been approved, and in this case you prosecuted because, as I understand it, he wasn't residing at the street corner where he said he was going to reside. What if the facts were slightly different? A homeless person is told, I'm not going to accept a street corner as your place of residence. I'm going to require you to reside within the confines of a motel room or some other structure. And he can't do it or she can't do it. Is that a violation of the statute that leads to a Category B felony?
I would hesitate to say yes because I don't believe probation and parole enforces the statute in
that
way.
I'm not talking about the practical application. I'm asking whether or not those hypotheticals violate the statute and create a Category B felony, yes or no?
I do not believe so.
Why not?
Because I believe that would be capricious, that would be arbitrary and capricious if someone were to enforce the statute in that type of way.
So I guess you would concede that this provision of the statute that the chief was asking about is itself ambiguous as a basis for a criminal prosecution of a Category B offense.
I don't believe it's ambiguous in the way that it's actually enforced in the sense of the way probation and parole enforces this requirement is that they are going to approve an address that meets the other requirements that are in the statute, that is 500 feet from a school, a church, and etc. So as long as they are enforcing the statute as it's set forth, then I don't believe that it's improper.
Okay. Any other questions, colleagues?
No?
Thank you. Ms. Dickinson, before you get started, would you just tell me the very limited nature of what is in fact required for lifetime supervision, assuming the board doesn't have any power to create any additional terms and conditions?
Well, for lifetime supervision, there's the residency requirements, where they have to have the residence approved, and they cannot be residing within 500 feet of an area where children are housed. Those are two separate requirements, but they both have to do with residency. And if they change the residency, they need to get that approved.
And that's it. That's it.
Oh, no. The other thing is they're not allowed to have any contact with the victim or witness, And then there's the optional requirement, and that is the probation parole department can place him on electronic monitoring. That's it. Those are the only requirements.
Okay, so the conditions, the additional conditions that the board imposed were specifically what? The year analysis?
Oh, there's 21
additional conditions.
Actually,
okay.
I think there's like almost 26.
And your point is if the legislature chose to delegate to the board the opportunity to create additional conditions, they would have so said.
Absolutely. They would have said that.
Thank you.
Okay. And they didn't say that. In the Lugman case, which the prosecutor spoke about, they did say that. They did specifically give them direction as to what to do. And it was very limited because they were identifying controlled substances. In this case, the legislature did not specifically say it. And the words that shall establish by regulation, when I look at the regulations that they put forth, it was how they would react to a person being put on lifetime supervision. And that's my understanding what the legislature meant in the first subsection. If you look at NRS 213.0988, the legislature used similar language there. They used the language adopted by regulation. What did they mean? They told the probation parole department to establish some guidelines on how they were going to make recommendations on pre-sentence reports. So that is the way I believe the plain meaning of that should be interpreted. With regard to the second section, lifetime supervision shall be deemed a form of parole. None of those apply here. It has to do with collecting fees, powers of a parole and probation officer, duties, and military service. None of that applies here. None of that applies to given conditions.
Your opponent mentioned that the statute as originally promulgated did not list any conditions, yet it was in 95 or 99 that the statute first came into being, and that those conditions were added later by the legislature. Is that correct?
As best I recall, that is correct. And it was just
so your position analytically is that as originally enacted, the statute is entirely unconstitutional because the legislature cannot delegate as a separation of powers matter the authority to promulgate the conditions of lifetime supervision?
I guess my position under the current statute is the plain meaning of the statute only allows a few conditions.
But statutory text doesn't change meaning when new paragraphs are added to it necessarily. Usually they carry forward the meaning that they had, even absent ambiguity. So if the statute originally gave parole and probation the power to enumerate conditions because it tasked them with establishing a program of lifetime supervision and presumably to have that program they had to put some conditions on the people they were supervising. Originally they had the authority you now say they don't have, right?
Well, Your Honor, neither party briefed that particular issue.
But I'm not
that familiar with the legislative history because my argument was the plain meaning of it. And with the court's permission, I would brief it and submit some supplemental authorities on it.
It's a fair request. We'll take that up afterwards. So you're not prepared to address what the statute meant when it was originally
enacted? Put on lifetime supervision under this current statute.
I understand that.
So neither party went back and looked at the other statute. In fact, the state did not even address any of our statutory construction arguments in the brief. If you look at my reply.
I'm aware of that. I'm just trying to read the statute correctly.
Right. I would need to go back and research that.
Thank you.
Mr. Consigna, if I may, Chief.
Yes.
In the lifetime supervision agreement signed by Mr. McNeil, there are somewhere between 21 and 27 conditions. One of them, as an example, requires him to submit to a polygraph examination on request. Fairly common requirement for those who are on probation or parole for a sex offense.
Right.
There is no similar requirement in 213-1243. If Mr. McNeil had been requested to submit to a polygraph, could they have prosecuted him for a Category B offense?
Yes. I think they would. I don't think they can.
Well,
that's I'm going to clarify what I'm saying there. I mean, because they prosecuted him for violation of curfew, so I could see that they would prosecute him for...
Can he be convicted?
Pardon?
Can he be convicted of a Category B felony for refusing to submit to a polygraph exam on demand by the Division of Parole and Probation?
No, I don't believe he can be. Nor can he be convicted under all the requirements that are listed in the pleadings. If I could just say one other thing about the pleadings, this is not just the pleadings being pled and there are. We have the closing argument where the prosecutor is saying, well, all you have to do is find out he didn't fulfill counseling, which is not one of the requirements, and you can convict him. So if you look at the pleadings and the closing argument, there's a problem with this conviction.
Okay, colleagues, any other questions? No? Well, thank you both for your presentations and your briefing in this matter, and the matter will stand submitted. Thank you.
Yeah.